It's 18th of October 2011. It's around 5:30. My name is Millie Lake. This interview forms part of the Brand Responsibility Oral and Digital History Project housed at the University of Washington. Could you begin by just stating your name and title for the record?
Sure. My name is Alexander Boris. I'm a third-year student at Cornell University in the School of Industrial and Labor Relations.
Okay, thank you. So the first question we want to ask you is just in what capacity you're involved in labor issues here on the Cornell campus, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two labor groups on Cornell's campus, the Cornell Organization for Labor Action, COLA for short, and Cornell Students Against Sweatshops, which is a chapter of the National United Students Against Sweatshops. They work closely together, meet together, and at times are indistinguishable, but technically two groups. During the Nike campaign, and so during the calendar year of 2010, I was president of Cornell Students Against Sweatshops. So I helped to organize some of the efforts at Cornell's campus. And since then, I've been involved in other issues at Cornell's campus, including the Sweat Free Ithaca bill that we passed to Ithaca and a few other initiatives.
Okay, perfect. So if we could just begin with the Nike case, and if I could just ask you to speak about what the key issues in that case were and how they first came to your attention, and then what course of action you as the president of COLA took to move those forward.
Absolutely. So the main issues in the Nike case were the closing of two factories in Honduras, both of which closed without paying workers legally mandated severance pay, both of whom produced primarily for Nike. I think one up to 80% of their merchandise was Nike, and the other was 60% Nike. And in one of them in particular, workers had been denied health care for a few months leading up to the closing of the factory, in that the employer, the factory, had not been paying the contributions to the government for workers for health care. And the workers only found out about this when one worker actually got deathly sick, went to the hospital and couldn't get treatment, and later ended up actually dying of cancer. Not to say that necessarily could have been prevented, but was unable to get health care. And so those were the immediate issues. When I first heard of what was going on, it had been over a year since the factories had closed. They had closed in January of 2009, and I heard about the situation along with other Cornell students in February of 2010 when we went to the United Students Against Sweatshops National Conference in Knoxville, Tennessee. And so that's when we heard about what had gone on in Honduras, how the workers, at this point, 13 months later, were still without any sort of severance, without any compensation. And so that's when we really got involved in trying to do something about it. And I think the most encouraging thing was hearing at that point the plan that we had in place to do something about it, which was to, like in the Nike case, use the power that our universities have over licensees to influence their behavior. So it's to target our universities to pressure the licensees, such as Nike, to change what was going on. And so I went to that conference with two other Cornell students, Casey Sweeney, who is now actually on the coordinating committee for United Students Against Sweatshops, and Bill Peterson, who was a senior at that time. Both Casey and I were freshmen. And on the drive home, we basically just started planning out a Cornell-specific strategy, how we thought we could raise awareness of the issue, get students, faculty, staff behind it, and get the university to actually take action. And so I remember the car ride home just being incredibly excited, and I normally fall asleep in any car ride I'm in, but I was up all 12 hours like planning the whole time because I just felt so empowered that we could actually do something. So we started with kind of educational events. We held what we called teach-ins, which are just sort of open information sessions about the actions Nike had taken. We would quarter cards, just pass out little index size sheets of information. Also telling people about the teach-in. So we always wanted to link it to the next event that was going on to slowly spread awareness. And then we also used campus media as much as possible. So every time we were doing an action, we sent a press release to the Cornell Daily Sun just so that people that might not have seen the action could read about it the next day and get involved. And I think one of the large turning points was when we actually, well, I should slow down. But one of the first things we did was actually give a letter to the president of the university, kind of before we did anything else, explaining what had gone on in Honduras, explaining Nike's relation to the factories, explaining Cornell's relation to Nike, which at the time was pretty substantial. Nike both sold apparel in our bookstores and was the main sponsor for most of Cornell's athletic teams. And so we explained that connection, then we explained why we thought it was Nike's moral responsibility to pay the severance pay that was owed to these workers. And so then after we delivered the letter and got a response basically saying, you know, we have a good relation with Nike, we'll look into it, we'll not promising any concrete action, was when we started doing the informational events. And I think one of the big moments was when we actually got two workers from the factories in Honduras that came to Cornell as part of a worker tour. And administrators came, students came, and actually got to talk to people who had been laid off. You know, we are talking about these issues, but when they're right in front of you, that's something else.
Can I just stop you absolutely. And ask who coordinated that tour? Was that USAS National Chapter, or was it WRC, or...?
So that USAS Nationals kind of traveled with them and organized it. And as far, I mean, WRC may have been involved. Okay. As far as I know, it was USAS.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, we helped raise funds, but they organized the whole tour. And so Gina and Loli came to visit, met with administrators, and that was, I think, really important. One of the things that our school did early on that a lot of schools in general have done when faced with kind of student movements is they form a committee to look at it. And so ours was called the Cornell University Licensing Oversight Committee, featured seven administrators and two students, me and Bill Peterson. Included someone from athletics because of the athletic teams sponsored, someone from the Cornell store, along with a variety of other administrators. And so many of them got to actually meet with Gina and Loli when they were here, which I thought was particularly powerful, that they could directly communicate with these workers who had been affected. But as we gained more momentum, we started... and more people had heard of it, we started doing more to show how much support we had and to really kind of push the university to say, you know, we've been talking about this for a few months, it's time to take some action. So we gathered signatures or endorsements from over 30 organizations, student organizations. We, in the span of a week, collected 1,100 signatures of students who were in support. We got the student assembly to pass a resolution. Yeah, 1,100. We got the student assembly to pass a resolution endorsing the cause, and the university assembly, which was important because at Cornell, there's the each kind of constituency has its own assembly. So there's a student assembly, the graduate student assembly, the faculty senate, the employee assembly.
Okay.
And then the university assembly has people from every constituency.
Okay.
And is, in theory, overseeing the other assemblies, and also has direct control over the Cornell store. Or I shouldn't say direct control in that they make day-to-day decisions, yeah. but oversight over the Cornell store. And so we came, and they were like, are you asking for us to pass a resolution? Like, because we could just pass a resolution cutting off the Cornell store from selling Nike things. And we said, no, we think it should be a, like, university-level decision. We just want a statement of support behind it. And so when they passed it unanimously, that was a big step in actually getting the campaign forward.
Okay, that is fantastic. So I just have a few follow-up questions to that. The first is, how many students are involved in, like, approximately involved in the Cornell...
Students against sweatshops, yeah. It's at the time there were 8 really dedicated seniors, and I'd probably say 8 to 10 juniors, sophomores, freshmen. Okay. At the time the campaign started.
Okay, and that was the kind of group involved in strategizing. Planning out all of these actions, et cetera.
Yeah, and I should say, as it went on, more people came in. Right, okay. Absolutely.
And then when you would hold awareness-raising events and things like that, how many, what kind of participation would you get?
So we, the first teach-in that we did, which was conducted by myself, Casey Sweeney, who I mentioned, Lance Kampa,
okay.
And Professor Suraj Karubla.
Okay.
Who's also a professor at ILR. That teaching, we went to teachers or professors of most labor-related classes and asked them if they'd be willing to give extra credit to their students for going, and most were.
Great.
So students turned out in droves. I think that one we had about 75, 80 students packed into a room for 60.
Wow.
To hear. So that was really encouraging. So it depended on the event and how much extra credit we got teachers to give out, but you know, at times turned out a substantial amount of people. Yeah.
Okay, and there was obviously really widespread support if you collected 1,100.
Right, exactly.
That's a good indication. Okay, and then how you mentioned raising funds for the tour, the campus tour. How did you do that? What kind of fundraising?
So that's not that difficult. Cornell is very good about giving funding to student organizations.
Okay.
So that was filling out a form.
Okay.
And there wasn't much fundraising involved in that.
Okay, it's just useful to know all the
right.
steps. And then when you were doing these teach-ins, and you said you were talking to faculty about presenting in student classes, but how, I guess I'm trying to understand how much of your attention was focused on raising like awareness and activism among the student population, and then how much was trying to build support from faculty and administrators and, you know, more senior level people.
Yeah. So I think it's definitely, you definitely have to do both.
Uh-huh.
Our kind of theory going into it, I actually believe that the administration was very willing to work with us.
Okay.
But our belief going into it was that they wouldn't be. And so while we thought we could make a very plausible and good case before them, both on a moral grounds and just on a strict, they clearly violated our code of conduct grounds, we thought from the beginning the only way that we'd get them to actually do something is if we had widespread support.
Okay.
So getting to have these events that we were routinely turning people out to, getting coverage in the newspaper, and especially getting faculty support and getting faculty to write in, we thought was incredibly important to kind of urging the administration to move on this faster.
Okay. And then, so my other question, you mentioned the code of conduct. Are you talking about, does Cornell have its own code of conduct as well as the WRC and FLA codes of conduct?
Yes. So okay. Cornell has a code of conduct. What I'm specifically referring to is Cornell follows the, I think it's called the Collegiate Licensing Company's standard contracts, which came about in like 2003, that a lot of universities adopted. And one of the things is that you'll be held responsible for your subcontractors.
Okay.
And so that's what we said, that we were violating that clause. But that contract's pretty, like, there, you can find a standard collegiate licensing company contract just out without a specific university or licensee in.
Okay.
And so those were the contracts that we said Nike violated.
Okay. So at University of Washington, a lot of the discussion, and I gather this was perhaps a source of tension, but a lot of the discussion was around two specific code of conduct provisions from the University of Washington's code of conduct, and one was code of conduct with Nike, and one was whether UW-specific goods were being produced in those specific factories, so in Hugger and Vision Tech.
Right.
And then the other issue was Nike's disclosure of that information, whether Nike was, you know,
obligated to
disclose that. And I think, I mean, generally the consensus on the committee, well, not the consensus, but the resolution was that they couldn't be sure whether Nike was producing, you know, whether UW goods were being produced at those factories, but that Nike was in violation of the code in terms of the disclosure of information. So I was asking Mike and Lance about these specifics, and Lance was speculating that he didn't think that was necessarily such an issue for Cornell, that the issue really was whether Nike good, you know, that there was no dispute that Nike goods were being produced at those factories, and so that was
right. That
was it as far as Cornell was concerned. So could you speak a little bit about that and what those kind of discussions
were
like?
Sure. Just before I should go back, when I mentioned the Licensing Oversight Committee,
yes.
Mike Powers was the chair of it, and
okay.
Lance Campa
mm-hmm.
sat on it along with Suresh Karuvala.
And were you
just
on that committee?
Yes,
well?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Bill Peterson and myself were the two student representatives.
Yeah. Okay.
Suresh Karuvala and Lance Campa were the faculty representatives. Mike Powers chaired it. There was Larry Quant from athletics, Kyle Kubik from student activities. Actually, I forget where Kyle was from. He only came to one meeting. But Catherine Holmes from Dean of Students Office, and might be forgetting. So there were 9 people total and 7 that were active in game.
Okay.
Just to kind of connect all
the
dots.
No,
yeah.
That's helpful.
So, but to the question I don't think it was certainly brought up whether Nike goods were made, or Cornell goods, I should say, were made in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear that Nike goods predominantly were. And so it was more Nike had violated the code. I think it'd be a pretty tenuous moral claim to make that just because there wasn't Cornell red, but there was some other school that
mm-hmm.
were fine with what was going on. So that, I don't think that, I would agree with Professor Compa that that wasn't a huge issue.
That's really interesting. Oh yeah, so you were talking as well about the moral responsibility of Nike. Was your position, either, you know, you personally or Cola, was the position that, did you take a position on whether Nike was in violation of Honduran law, or was it just the kind of code of conduct and the moral responsibility that you were focused on?
So I think looking at the technicality of it,
mm-hmm.
Nike wasn't in violation of Honduran law.
Yeah, that's
In that the people who are responsible by law are the factory owners and not whoever they sell to.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there was my recollection may be failing me, but I believe there was some ruling by a Honduran authority that these workers were just owed money still, not necessarily naming Nike. But so, I mean, we basically portrayed them as going through a loophole of Honduran law.
Yeah.
And we said, they're definitely violating our code of conduct. You know, they are going through a loophole in not violating Honduran law. And regardless of what the lawyers would say about either of those, they're clearly acting immorally.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of, we attacked it from all angles.
Okay, that's really helpful. And then I had another question related to that. Is there a chance we could follow up later and you might be able to find that reference that you talked about that there was a ruling?
Yeah.
Do you
Have
any way of tracking that down or recalling what that might be?
If you give me 5 minutes, I could search my email.
Yeah, not right now.
Yeah,
but maybe
yeah.
Like later.
You yeah, I'll see if I can find it.
But don't
yeah.
worry if you can't find it. So you also talked about you know, at the beginning when you were driving home and kind of strategizing that universities, like you wanted to leverage the university's institutional purchasing power.
Right.
So could you just say something about COLA and USAS in general strategy of kind of targeting universities and just why universities represent such a significant, I guess, actor in terms of multinational corporation contracts like this, because they don't necessarily represent the biggest financial percentage
right.
or like economic percentage of these companies' revenue, but what, you know, there
certainly,
are
certainly.
Why universities
With Nike in particular, universities represent, I forget the exact percentage, but it's like under 5% of their revenue. I think it was more like 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't an economic case, although still 2% of $4
yeah.
billion is is a lot of money.
Yeah.
But with universities, I think it's not so much that Unite Students Against Sweatshops or Cornell Students Against Sweatshops was targeting universities, so much as these corporations target universities as places where they can sell their wares. And it's just important that when they do that, the people of the university, the students, along with the faculty and the staff, have a say in what the standards are. So most of the universities already had codes of conduct. They already had agreed upon standards, and so while Nike might not have been violating Modell's code of conduct, right,
mm-hmm.
Modell's sporting goods, they were violating Cornell's,
mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was just, you know, as a student of Cornell, I felt like if they're going to do business with Cornell, they should follow our rules.
Yeah. Okay. And just to kind of follow up from that, why do you think this specific case and, you know, the Russell case as well, obviously, but these two cases are fairly big, you know, represent fairly big victories for labor unions in situations like this. Why do you think these two cases were successful, both at the corporate, I mean, I can only ask you to kind of speculate
right.
about what Nike's and Russell's concerns were, but if I could ask you to do that, and then also talk about why they were successful at the campus level, because it's only, you know, Cornell, University of Wisconsin,
right.
Madison, and then University of Washington, I believe, that actually took that action to threaten to allow the contracts to expire. So
I think Brown too
Brown
did,
as
but
well.
They like
okay.
didn't publicize it. Like, well, we found out about Brown after we found out that Nike had turned around and paid the
okay,
workers.
Right, okay.
But apparently they had technically done it.
So yeah, there are two
yeah.
separate questions. But.
So as to why they were successful from the corporate standpoint, like what changed the behavior, with Russell, I really think it was the workers, the students, everyone who's working on this really actually hit them in their wallets. They went from being the 8th most popular collegiate licensee
mm-hmm.
to the 20th.
Wow.
In the course of the campaign, they were dropped by a major retailer that's now escaping me, if it was Sports Authority or Dick's, but one of them dropped Russell in something they had claimed they would never do.
Mm-hmm.
So it was reaching outside of just universities as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they didn't want to change around, and they were basically forced to by just overwhelming support from people all over the country. I mean, there's no way it could get done with just
mm-hmm.
people working in Honduras or just students working in the United States or it was, you know, the fact that Russell was getting bombarded from all over that changed it. With Nike, clearly they hadn't reached that point yet. My speculation is, A, they saw the light at the end of the tunnel and they saw where it was going. Russell had just happened like 6 months before. B, Nike is very brand sensitive. And in the past has gone through bouts of huge anti-sweatshop protests. Right. And so I think they kind of wanted to nip it in the bud before it got steam. But I mean, it how quickly they reacted shows how much these issues can resonate with people once they're made aware of them. So people weren't aware of what happened in Honduras in either case, and when they were told about it, they were angry and they acted.
And did you have any direct communication with Nike representatives?
Early on, we talked. There was a conference call with a few of us and Amanda Tucker, who is head of corporate social responsibility at Nike. And so we had a 30-minute conversation with her, maybe it was an hour, in response to the first letter we sent, where basically she just kind of assured us, you know, everything's fine. We might think about helping them, but we're not responsible. Nothing's going to change, so on and so forth. So I personally didn't have much communication in ways of actually changing their minds. But I did talk to them. Yeah.
And did you get the sense, again, like either yourself personally or you, Cecil Kohler, that Nike was grudgingly kind of willing to cooperate or just very kind of resistant to engaging with this until they were really forced into it?
I think they were always willing to engage. I don't think they were willing to do anything about it. Like, they're willing to talk us to death. And, you know, that they were wise enough to not think ignoring would be the way to go forward. But one of the humorous aspects after the campaign was they put up a website about what was going on in Honduras, and one of the things on there is this line that was basically like, we will never pay, we will never take the financial responsibilities of a subcontractor, right? We think that's a separate issue. And the day they announced that they were actually, you know, paying the workers and doing it, they hadn't yet taken down the website. So there's a screenshot in my email somewhere that was sent out over USS of that website saying we'll never pay, right? Yeah. Next to Nike announces
would be able to send me that, like, I mean, there might be some materials that I to get off you.
Oh yeah, like, definitely. Yeah, yeah,
good to put this stuff in the archive. So yeah, and just, sorry, I want to go back to the other question, but while we're on this topic, like, I know Nike was pretty careful in the wording of the compensation package,
right,
not to kind of set a financial, you know, legal precedent that they were taking legal responsibility for this. So do you feel like, were you dissatisfied with the wording of the compensation package, or was that kind of what you expected?
I think to anyone that studies what happened or was involved in what happened, it was very clear what it was. I obviously wasn't involved in putting out the final wording, but from my perspective, I wouldn't want the workers waiting even an extra day over the wording of the thing. I think that was much more important. But to Nike, it's clear that the legal precedent is important.
Right.
But I think hopefully establishing the practice
helps
there to be accountability through the system, because the way it's set up right now, there's no accountability, and these severance laws are nearly impossible to enforce.
Well, if I could go back to then the other question about why Cornell, you know, why the students at Cornell basically kind of mounted such an effective strategy in terms of, I don't know, would you say pressuring the administration is the right word, or?
I don't think, I don't think it was pressure in terms of there was ever a, like, you need to do this or else. The only or else was, look how foolish you look when all of these students and members of the community support this and you're saying no. Like, who are you protecting?
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, sorry, that wasn't the question. That was
no, that's important. So I guess, yeah, I'm just interested in your thoughts on why Cornell, why you feel that Cornell did kind of take this course of action that a lot of other US schools didn't yet take, and whether you got a sense of that there was a real kind of domino effect about to follow from your colleagues at USAS chapters around the country, and that there was a kind of drive. I guess I'm asking multiple questions in
one,
but hopefully you can get where I'm going. Like, why did Cornell take such a leadership role in this? Was it to do with, you know, the students, or was it to do with the fact that you had such a good relationship with the administrators and the faculty, or what?
Yeah, well, answering the first part about the domino, I definitely think it was clear that momentum was building, because there's always the question of, oh, if no other school's done it, like, why should we? Mm-hmm. And then once a few schools have cut and said it's violating the contract, is why are we still with them if other schools are saying it? So when University of Wisconsin cut first, that was, you know, that was a fairly large contract they cut, and it was very substantial, but so not to belittle that at all, but Nike wasn't their athletic sponsor, so it wasn't a quote-unquote Nike school. Cornell was a Nike school, and so when they had a big contract at University of Wisconsin-Madison cut, and then at Cornell a relatively smaller contract, but still at a Nike school, I think it showed that Nike could lose wherever it was.
Yeah.
And there was really a possibility of going forward. As to why we were, why the campaign was effective, I think we had a few benefits going for us. I mean, we had the School of Industrial and Labor Relations, which gave us interested faculty that had done research, people that are willing to help us. We had an administration that was willing to work with us. Mike Powers, who was on the board of the Workers' Rights Consortium as we were going over the campaign. And then we had an incredible group of students. So, I mean, we had, as I said, almost half the club was seniors, and they were all very active, very involved, knew what was going on, and were willing to step in. And at the same time, when they saw how passionate Casey and I were, you know, let kind of us, even though we were freshmen, let us really step in and lead and keep the energy high.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we had a lot of factors that played in our favor.
Okay. And so in terms of your participation in the committee, the licensing oversight committee meetings, how did the discussion in those meetings go? I mean, two questions really. Was there a lot of consensus among the different parties, or like kind of disagreement or discussion? And then also, if you could just talk a little bit about the process of those meetings as well, like what kinds of questions were coming up and like how you got to the final resolution.
Sure. So there were a number of actual times when we sat down and met. The early ones were much more fact-finding, discussing the Workers' Rights Consortium reports, which is where we got all the information about what was going on, and also kind of discussing how to engage with Nike, which, you know, like setting up the calls with Amanda Tucker and the letters and drafting how we can question without threatening and things like that. And then as it got later and it got clear Nike wasn't going to do anything, kind of where we, you know, it came time for people to actually take action. And so I think the final recommendation to the president to actually cut the contracts, if I remember correctly, passed 6-1 and then technically 8-1 because the two people that hadn't come to meetings were like, yeah, I like it. But but the vote when it happened was 6-1.
Okay.
the one person being the representative from athletics.
I heard that.
Yeah. So, you know, eventually everyone who was there came around.
Okay.
And actually Lance Compa, in one of the final meetings, was very pivotal in that he brought a draft of the letter. So we were coming to like discuss what our final recommendation would be, and he brought with him a recommendation to cut, like already worded and how you would give a letter, and it made it very easy to just be like, yeah, that's what we should do. And there's no reason to delay drafting it for, but.
So were there discussions over, so prior to that point when you kind of knew that that was the course of action you were going to take, were there discussions over what, like what the best strategy to play with Nike was, like whether to kind of have a more gentle approach or whether to go on the attack immediately and stuff like that? Is that the kind of, were you talking about that, or was it pretty unified, like how you would
within the licensing oversight committee,
right?
Yeah, there were definitely talks about how we should go forward. And that's why I think there was a slow escalation of like a kind letter, then a you guys need to do something letter, and then finally the last one.
And were you at any point like frustrated with the pace of how things were moving?
Constantly. Okay. just being an impatient freshman, but B,
yeah.
Like actually delays were rather frustrating.
Yeah.
It was part of the process, and it was just, you know, as long as people were actually working on things, it was bearable.
Okay.
And rarely, I won't say never, but rarely did I get the feeling that they were just stalling the stall.
Okay.
So that was, you know, made it easier to deal with.
So I think, yeah, that's a definite contrast with the University of Washington case, where I think there was a sense that there were people on the committee,
yeah,
who were...
And I will say that's not the unanimous view of members of Cornell,
okay,
Students Against Sweatshop. There are certainly people from the group that would tell you they were stalling just to stall.
I see. Okay.
One of the examples actually was we were trying to get the Licensing Oversight Committee to meet towards the last week of school. We realized time was running down. And they like couldn't find a day to meet, even though me and Bill were literally like 24/7, like,
yeah,
whatever. And we just hadn't met for a while. And then President Scorton came to the student assembly meeting on a Thursday, which he just does every so often just to give updates. And they allow open questions. And one of our seniors, Andrew Wolf, like really kind of tore into him about why is the Licensing Oversight Committee not met yet? Like, why are you stalling? You know, let's actually take action on this. And like 2 days later, we had an email that was like, we're meeting on Monday.
Okay.
So there are certainly people that would point to that and say they were just stalling the stall.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I didn't get that feeling.
Okay. And did you get the sense that the president was fairly receptive to what the Licensing Oversight Committee would recommend? Like, it was left to you guys?
Yes and no. Not entirely. I never felt like what we were deciding was the decision.
Okay.
But I felt like having a strong recommendation, would be taken to heart. And we knew it would always be reviewed finally by President Scorton, Vice President Murphy, and Vice President Bruce to make the final decision. It's probably worth pointing out that the letter that Cornell sent to Nike was a step back from what the recommendation was. So the recommendation was an immediate cut of the licensing contract.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and what the final decision, what Cornell sent out, was we'll let it expire. We won't renew it at the end of the year.
I wish I knew this before. I didn't get that sense. I got the sense that the recommendation of the committee was to allow the contract to expire.
No, the recommendation was to cut.
Okay.
And then President Scorton decided to let it expire.
Okay.
So it was a step back, and you know that was frustrating for a bit. But
I had another question that slipped my mind now. Can I just ask, like, what involvement you've had since the settlement, since Nike's decision to settle? How satisfied you've been with, well, I guess how involved you've been with, kind of monitoring how the settlement has been implemented and how satisfied you've been with that.
So I haven't been that implemented myself. I know Lance Compa's been rather involved. But to the best of my knowledge, not a single worker has been rehired yet. And one of the things in there was priority rehiring and making sure that they actually got a job, and all the training in the world isn't worth anything if you don't have a chance to use it. So that's incredibly, incredibly frustrating. That, you know, they lost their livelihood and kind of still aren't being taken seriously about that loss. So, I mean, I would like to see them all rehired, and I would like to see them all working again. But so I can't say I'm satisfied with.
Yeah, that's helpful. Wow, okay. I think I did have more questions, but they're not coming to mind right now, and we've covered, like, a great amount of stuff. So can you think of anything that I haven't asked that you would want to note down, or?
No, I think that's pretty
comprehensive. Well, we can always speak by phone or by email, and I'd love to follow up. Okay, I'll stop the recording.